everyone. You know what that intro means. It's time once again for our little chats. As always, I seem to be apologizing for the time in between these chats, but what's the famous John Lennon quote? What life goes on, what is it? While we're busy making plans or something of that nature. At any rate, here I am doing another one of these podcasts. Most of you would probably recognize that intro that I did, and I want to again apologize for the quality of the recording. One of these centuries, whenever my studio gets actually done and finished, I will be ramping up the level of quality of my intros. And, you know, again, I apologize for that for all of you guitar and tone aficionados out there. Believe it or not, I'm really a tone freak, but you would never know it from some of the levels of the recording. for those of you who may or may not know that little intro, that was originally taken obviously from a Fogerty tune that was released, I think it was in 1969, while he was a member of CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival. If you guys and gals out there don't know who that is, you ought to go check them out. They're really really good band. They did some really catchy tunes, and John Fogerty was sort of the lead guy in the band and wrote most of the stuff, and almost all of the stuff actually, and just was sort of the driving force, and really, in my opinion, an underrated guitarist, and just got a great, very unique vocals that you can always identify. His brother Tom was the rhythm player in the band. Stu Cook was the bassist, and Doug Clifford was the drummer. They were a four-piece. Up until the time that Tom Fogerty left, the band had, like a lot of bands, had conflicts near the ending, and Tom dropped out, I think during the recording of Pendulum, which was their next to the last record they released, I think. But at any rate, the rumor goes, and of course I'm just repeating things I've heard. I don't know how true any of this is. Guys were wanting a more democratic band, and John sort of ran the band and sort of said, okay, well, sorry, but this is how the shit goes. And when he, Tom quit, and then they continued, I think, as a threesome for a couple of years after that, and then eventually broke up. John Fogerty, of course, has gone on to do numerous solo records and written some really cool stuff on his own. Evidently, he and his brother never quite reconciled. His brother died, I think, in 1990 from complications from AIDS that he got from a blood transfusion, I think undergoing some kind of a back or spine surgery. I don't remember which. At any rate, it was really unfortunate because I really thought that band was really cool. And I love John's stuff, solo stuff, obviously, too, although his gear has changed a little bit. Back in the day, you would see him playing a Rickenbacker a lot, and then sometimes a Les Paul. And when you see him, usually through a PV amp back in the day, which my understanding is he still owns to this day, even though I'm told that a roadie almost destroyed it during one of John's solo tours in Australia, that he kind of took it off the road, got it repaired, and stuck it in his home. I don't think it's left his house since then, but it's the same PV amp he had at Woodstock, supposedly, so I thought that was pretty cool. The original Woodstock, by the way, for those of you who are wondering. excuse me. Stu Cook and Doug Clifford, the bassist and drummer, eventually did a bunch of stuff on their own and eventually formed a band called Creedence Clearwater Revisited, which does a lot of old CCR stuff with new members, with a guy that plays guitar and sings very, very much. Vocally sounds a lot like John. And they do really well on their own, but, what can I tell you? There's nothing like the real thing. These days, what you see usually is Mr. Fogerty playing a Telecaster doing that song. But he's got oodles and oodles of guitars. If you've ever seen him on in concert, which I had the good fortune to do, he's got numerous guitars that he uses on stage, which include Tellies and Les Pauls and Rickenbackers and PRSs and all kinds of stuff. And through various amplifiers, ranging from, you know, Matchless to, you know, I guess Marshall, Fender. I can't really remember all the stuff I saw the last time I saw him. He's good. He puts on a very, very good show. He's a really accomplished performer, and I would highly recommend any of you who have any interest in classic rock to go check him out. CCR was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, in 93. And since the tensions with the band were still pretty heavy, I think John played a bunch of songs with Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. The other two weren't allowed to come on stage, which, you know, I understand when you have hard feelings, but I really, you know, obviously I don't think that's the classiest thing for folks to do, because, I mean, you know, this is not about, I hate to say this, and I mean no disrespect to John or anyone else, because, as I said, I really respect him as a performer, player, you know, writer, you know, and the other guys as well. But, you know, I kind of feel like them like I do about Kiss. You know, if you're going to play for the public, you know, your ass needs to suck it up and go on stage and do what you need to do, because this is really about the fans who supported you and made you what you are. And, you know, I think that you owe them a debt to do what you have to do to get by. I mean, it's, you know, 15 minutes on stage. How hard can that be, you know? But I get when people's feelings are hurt and upset and all that kind of junk. And, you know, I'm not minimizing any of that. But it just seems like folks could put that kind of stuff aside. That particular song I did has been re-recorded also by just boatloads of artists, and you've seen them on commercials and movies and that kind of stuff. And actually, John did a recording in, I think, 2013, where he did a remake of that, I think, with Foo Fighters on his CD, Wrote a Song for Everyone. At any rate, that was actually played for me on my James Burton Telecaster, which many of you know. James Burton was a studio musician for Sun Records back in the day, and then eventually started becoming Ricky Nelson's guitarist until his death, and then he became Elvis Presley's guitarist till his death, and he's still playing today. And my understanding is that, you know, he liked the sound of a Strat, but really liked the body of a Telecaster. So if you see any James Burton Telecasters, they're basically a Tele body with Strat electronics in them. So it's kind of the best of both worlds for folks such as myself who really dislike the control patterns on a Strat. I mean, I just absolutely hate them. I love Strat guitars in terms of their, you know, their looks and their tone and the way the neck feels, but whoever put the tone knobs on that thing should be shot. They get in my way every time I play them. I don't know how the hell, you know, guys who are very proficient on them, you know, including one of my favorite people, Eric Clapton, and, you know, Hendrix, and, you know, a shoot ton of other people use them. So obviously it's not the guitar, it's the players. And, you know, obviously I'm the guy who's flawed here, but I've just never been a Strat guy in terms of how, where the controls were put. And I actually saw a one-off that was done, my understanding, at the factory back in the day. Some guy says, hey, we need to move these controls and put them in a place that was like more behind the bridge, which is where I love the controls are, which is why I like Gibson guitars so much. Sorry, Fender. I do like Teles, though, you know. And Jaguars and Jazzmasters. I just don't like Strats playing them. At any rate, and I actually saw one at a show, but the guy wanted astronomical amounts of money for it. And I can't really blame him. It's probably a one-off, you know, prototype that was never realized. But it was definitely my cup of tea in terms of where the controls were. I was like, oh, my God, finally somebody gets it. But at any rate, you know, more power to all you Strat guys, which, as I said, include David Gilmour and Robin Trower and, you know, a boatload of people, Eric Clapton, a boatload of people who are a whole lot better guitar players than I'll ever be. So there you go. But at any rate, I that's why I love the Tele Strats, the James Burtons, because they're just the best of both worlds. So I get to have a Strat tone with a Tele body and a neck. I mean, it's awesome. Why I have two of them. James Burtons, that is. I have about 10 or 12 Teles, but I digress. And actually, I was doing that through a, although you, again, you know, my apologies for the crappy recording, through one of the Kemper profilers, which for those of you who haven't seen those, they are, they're pretty amazing things. And this is from a guy who is a diehard, you know, old school tube amplifier kind of guy. But I mean, just, and I'm not an electrician or electronics guy. So for those of you who are much more tech savvy than I am, which would, you know, probably be anybody over the age of four, I'm going to give you the idiot's version because that's the only thing I can do because I am when it comes to this stuff. Basically, the Kemper, you know, most of you probably who are musicians out there know about the emulation and the line sixes and the digital modeling and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of guys and gals out there, manufacturers, do it these days. And they're all, you know, to varying degrees, lesser or greater sound, pretty good to, oh my God, this sounds horrid. However, the Kemper profiler does it through a different mechanism where you're actually recording the amp live that you're then storing in with a mic and then storing in digital format into a memory. I mean, the thing is really the bomb. I cannot say enough nice about that thing. And thanks to the wonderful folks at the Amp Factory in England, and in particular in Andy, who's one of their guys that does stuff. They're a company out in England that goes around. One of the things they do is, I mean, they do a lot of different services, but one of the things they do is profile classic amplifiers and some new stuff and use really, really high-end microphones and do a really, really fabulous job of capturing the sweet spots and the tones of various classic amplifiers that most of us peons could not afford to buy, and then take the profiles and really get them down perfectly that are made for things like the Kemper, and then sell them to folks like myself to load into the Kemper so that, you know, you too can own a piece of history and have amps that you could never afford if you could even find them. So I really wanted, my hat's off to Andy. He really has done a superb job. He and his crew at the Amp Factory have done a superb job. So if any of you who have designs or desires in that realm, I would really, really advise you to look up the Amp Factory. They're online, and Kemper Profilers, that's with a K, good old German company, and check them out. So they're really, really good, and Andy was very, very helpful in guiding me when I asked him about some of the profiles they did and questions, and he actually answered me in, you know, in non-techie English that a moron such as myself could understand. So that was really amazing. Andy must have like a translator chip in his head. Oh, my Lord. But anyway, hats off to those folks, and obviously to CCR and John Fogarty and Doug Clifford and Stu Cook and Tom Fogarty, rest in peace, and all the great guys and gals out there who do rock and roll and do what they do so well and enhance all of our lives. I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to spend that much time doing trivia, but, you know, as I usually get sidetracked, and most of you who listen to these podcasts are probably, some of you are probably musicians, and at the very least probably are amused by my trivia history of, you know, facts that most people wouldn't give two flips about, but I do because I'm a nerd, and that's what nerds do. I just happen to have a nerd potential for music and tone and that sort of thing. Which most people that are nerds don't, and most musicians are a lot smarter about this than I am, but, you know, I digress. What I wanted to kind of lead that into today was a talk about, you know, what I call micro decisions that all of us make in our lives, little decisions, little choices, because really it's the accumulation of the little choices that end up, you know, at the end of our road, determining what kind of outcomes we have. You know, people talk about, especially in the addiction field, you know, which is how I got into this. Most of you probably know the story. Anybody who knows me knows the story. But for listeners who've been following me for a while, and thank you all very much for who've continued to follow me despite my erratic postings. I really want to thank you a lot. That the decisions that people make in the addictions field, you know, they talk about, oh, you know, relapse cues and relapse prevention and strategies to avoid stuff, and all that stuff's really good. I'm not poo-pooing that at all. But, you know, you could say the same thing for folks who get triggered who have post-traumatic stress disorder or who have dissociative identity disorder, which is what used to be called multiple personalities. You know, all of these things have environmental triggers that sort of set off a series of thoughts and feelings inside a person's head, and if they don't manage those pretty well, that they can kind of, you know, take them places they don't want to go and encourage them to do things they really shouldn't be doing and under normal circumstances wouldn't do. But aside from all the major stuff that, you know, most of us would think of, well, you know, losing a pet or getting in a car wreck or getting kicked out of college or relapsing on drugs or, you know, being physically or emotionally or sexually abused or, you know, being kidnapped by a motorcycle gang or aliens or whatever, you know, or losing your money on the stock market as many, you know, folks did back a few years ago and, you know, or, you know, some of the terrible things you folks hear about on the news, which is one reason I don't watch the news because I don't want to see the crazy, terrible things that happen to people because it just makes me more angry and I feel sadder about the state of affairs of humanity or, you know, such as it is. At any rate, and then the sufferings of a lot of folks who get, you know, put in prison for many years for things they didn't do and all this crazy stuff in the Middle East and, you know, over here and everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. I'm not picking on anybody. It's, you know, people are nuts everywhere and do stupid shit everywhere. You don't have to be, you know, somebody in the Middle East or in France or America or England or whatever. I mean, you know, there's nutcases everywhere and there's religious crazy asses everywhere and there's good people and sincerely spiritual people everywhere. It's just that you don't hear about them as much because, you know, as Don Henley would say in his Dirty Laundry song, you know, it's you know, bad news and bad stuff and tragedy and, you know, stuff sells copy. And that's unfortunate, and it wouldn't if we weren't consumers of it, which is one reason I don't watch TV. But, you know, you can't be a total ostrich with his head in the sand and his, you know, tush in the air all the time. So occasionally I hear about stuff, and it's just I just kind of shake my head and go, okay, well, thanks. I wish I didn't know that now, you know, like the famous Bob Seger line in one of my favorite songs, Against the Wind, wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. But it's often not the big stuff. You know, it's really what happens is sometimes the big stuff, particularly like in the addiction field when folks do relapses, you know, you hear all the time, well, I didn't really choose to do a relapse. I didn't plan to do a relapse. You know, well, I know you didn't plan it. Well, most people don't. Some people don't give a flip and they go, screw it. I'm going to relapse because what the heck? I'm going to die anyway. I might as well have fun and, you know, eat tons of crappy food and, you know, sugar and hydrogenated fats and, you know, Burger King and McDumbo's and Awful House and, you know, these other kind of crazy things that people go to and eat that I haven't been to in 30 years. Thank you, Jesus. But, you know, it's the small decisions that people make that lead up to that, okay? So let's assume that you have somebody who isn't totally idiotic and moronic and trying to dismiss all the data that we have, you know, about how bad the crap that's in our food is, you know. And by the way, for any of you who have ever doubted it or ever thought it was a bunch of, you know, crazy people like me just raising flags and jumping up and down and a bunch of, you know, overage hippie freaks or whatever, or, you know, new nuke veggies or vegans or, you know, gluten-frees or whatever, watch a movie called Fed Up. It is the bomb. I mean, that movie tells it the way it is, and it's preaching what I've been saying for the last 25 years, and people just roll their eyes and go, yeah, we know he's an obsessive compulsive freakazoid, but no, I am that, but I'm right also. So shut up and watch the movie, and it says it much better than I can. But going back to this small decision, it's the small decisions people make that accumulate up and end up in a big decision that sometimes gets people into a lot of trouble. You know, and some of you may be going, well, what the hell is this guy talking about? Well, I'm glad you asked that. Don't you love these people that talk to themselves? Usually happens when I'm not on my Thorazine, but I digress once again. But seriously, it's the things that people do when they're not even realized they're doing it. So let me give folks a kind of concrete example that I think they can follow pretty well. Okay, so let's say that you're a person who has, you're in college or high school or whatever, and you have a big test coming up on Monday, and Friday, it's now Friday, and you know that if you want to do well on the test, even if you've kept up with your homework very well or the reading assignments or whatever, it's going to be a big deal test on Monday. It's going to be really a ball buster, and you're going to have to, you know, put the pedal to the metal, and really, you know, nose to the grindstone and do your studying if you want to make a really good grade. And let's say you're one of these people that's kind of on the border and you're like, God, I've got to have a good grade on this thing. I've, you know, kind of, and I really want an A, or, ooh, I really want to pass, or, you know, whatever your particular scenario is. So Friday you're getting out of class and you're going home and you just want to relax a couple hours before you start to kind of get into it because you know you're going to be doing it, right? And you have full intentions of doing what you need to do and studying and, you know, doing well on the test on Monday and showing up, you know, 9 o'clock Monday morning and, you know, kicking butt and taking names. And one of your best buddies calls you up or texts you or whatever your mode of communication is and says, hey, about 6:30, you've had a little snack and you're going to study a little bit, then you're going to have another snack and you're going to do intermittent snacks to keep your brain going. So you've planned this thing out, right? So you've made decisions to study and you've kind of prepped it. So those are little decisions that are good, right? So then your buddy calls you about 6:30 or 7 and says, hey, I know you're studying for this big test and I don't want to distract you, but this buddy of mine's giving up a bang-up party, and there's going to be some really cool folks there. And, you know, why don't you take a break? It's only a couple of miles from your house, and tool all down and stay a couple hours, and I'll make sure to kick you out at 11 o'clock, and, you know, you get home and do some stuff, and, you know, we'll make sure that I'll remind you not to get drunk, or I'll remind you to, you know, limit to one beer, or, you know, whatever your thing is. And you go, no, my gosh, I really can't. And you hang up the phone and you're just going, and so the wheels are turning in your head. Well, you know, maybe, come on, it's just for 2 hours, you know, it's 7:30, okay, I'm going to study for another hour and a half, I'm going to have a snack, and then I'm going to show up about 9:15, I'll stay to 11, and then I'll leave. I mean, I'm just going to be there an hour and a half, okay, you know, I can do that, because then I'll come home, right, and you're talking yourself into this shit, right, even though your back burner, you know, your brain, you're the logical, rational part of you is going, okay, you know that if you go to that party, and there's some hot chicks or hot guys or whatever your thing is, right? You know you're not coming home. Stop deluding yourself. You know you're not going to just have one toke on the doobie. You know you're not just going to have one beer. You know you're not just going to have one line. You're going to go hog wild. Look what happened last weekend. Hello, McFly, don't be doing it. Come on. I can do it. Come on, my buddy said he's going to help me. Don't do it. You're going to screw yourself. I'm telling you. Oh, shut. Oh, come on. I'm fine. I'm going to do it. I'm really going to. Right. And so you make the decision to go to the party. Now, you've already made a bunch of small decisions to talk yourself into going to the party to begin with, right? Because you really don't want to study. I mean, let's face it. Who wants to study unless you're a nerd like me or you're taking a subject that you really get off on? And how many of those do you get to take in school, right? Yeah, I don't really want to study. And so you're kind of making, I won't be, you know, I need a break, right? You're making up all these rationales, all these, you know, excuses. They're not really, they're rationalizations, okay? They're not rational thinking. There's a big difference, okay? Rationalization is an excuse people make to do the stuff that they know they shouldn't be doing, but they're trying to talk themselves into doing it and making it okay and going, and most of those folks, even when I do it, I say to those folks or myself, you know, I've got some really good cheese to go with that wine you're doing right now, but I digress again. So you talk yourself into going to the party, or talk yourself out of doing the smart thing, which is, nope, I'm going to buckle down, I'm going to stay here, I'm going to study, because what happens if I run into some shit I don't know, and meanwhile, you've wasted time talking yourself into this, by the way, right? So however many minutes or whatever go by. So 9:15 comes, you go, hey, it's 9:15, time for me to go to the party, right? And you're kind of checking the clock the whole time you're studying. So now you've already made the decision, which means your mind is really not on studying. Even if you had the greatest of intentions, right? You're peeking at the clock every, you know, you didn't do shit like set the clock for 9:15 just to ring so you wouldn't have to worry about it. Most people don't do that. That would be another small decision that would be a good idea if, in fact, you were going to the party, which is a bad idea, but we already established that, right? But again, small decisions. Oh, I won't, you know, I don't need an alarm. So if you use rationalization, you know, excuses for doing what you want to do that aren't in your best interest, that's different from rational thinking, which is looking at it logically, rationally from what I call a reality perspective, right? Rationalization is not about reality thinking. It's about emotional thinking, which is, you know, to quote Mr. Mackey on South Park, bad and kind. So you don't want to be doing that. But 9:15 comes, you go, oh gosh, got to go. I'd love to sit and study, not, but I got to go. So you close the book, you get in the car, you go, or you get on your bike or whatever your deal is. You go to the party, and of course you know what happens, right? It's 2 o'clock, you know, you see people you haven't seen. Oh yeah, you have more than you know you're going to have, and you know, you meet some people, whatever, right? And so now it's 2:30, and you don't really want to leave, but you got to leave. You know, you screwed up. Part of you is ruminating. I told you not to come here. Okay, you screwed up again, dude. Come on. Right. And you go in anyway. And so you finally show back up. You come in at 3 in the morning, right? And if, you know, if you're an underage person, you're sneaking in, praying to Jesus, God, Buddha, Satan, Allah, and any other deity, you know, that you're not going to wake your folks up, right? So you show up. You come in. Now you're tired and you're a little hungover or you're a little whatever. And you're like, oh, I'm just, and you look at the stuff and you're like, oh, I don't want to, I don't want to study. Right? And you talk yourself into going to sleep. I just need to sleep. I'll be, you know, I'm going to do this tomorrow. I'm going to start early in the morning. I'm going to set my alarm for 8 o'clock and I'm going to get up. Right. So the alarm goes, and you know damn well you're not, right? So you set the alarm and you have great intentions. And you folks all know about the old saying about, you know, the road to hell is paved with great intentions, right? So the alarm goes off at 8 o'clock and you roll over and you go, oh, hell no. If you're from the South, you go, oh, hell no. It's entirely too early for my butt to be out of bed. What the hell? I'm from the South, so I can slam it, okay? So you put the snooze button on, right? So you make the decision you're going to put the – notice how small all these decisions are, right? You're putting the snooze button on. You're sleeping. The snooze button – doesn't work, or you hit it too hard, or you knock it off, or you go, screw it, I need my sleep, because I can't focus if I'm sleepy, and you turn the alarm off, even worse, after the second snooze button, right? So your lazy butt rolls out of bed about 1:30, and you're like, oh my God, I want you, now I got to get something, right? So now you're not rolling and going until about 3, right? So now you're studying for a couple hours, you're tired, you take a break. You turn on the TV to give yourself a little 30-minute break, and you see a movie you've always wanted to see. Oh, my God. Wow. You know what? I've been studying, right? And you guys and gals all know where this is going, right? So by the time this scenario is over, when about 7 or 8 o'clock Sunday night rolls around, you've already made a shit ton of bad decisions, right? You've already procrastinated. You've done a half-baked attempt, and now you're freaking out because you realize you haven't allotted enough time to do what you need to do, and you're going to be pulling an all-nighter, right? And for those of you who haven't heard earlier podcasts or don't know about the research, let me save you the trouble, right? Practicing all at one time under pressure, which is called massed practice, right? Research is very clear that that's not your best technique to remember stuff, okay? And that also, when your stress is increased, as all of you know, performance is decreased. So now you're putting yourself under stress and you're trying to mass practice stuff you should have been doing a lot earlier. But no, you waited till the last minute, right? And you're going over in your head how much time you wasted, and you're beating the crap out of yourself about the movie you watched and the party you went to and, you know, the too many beers or whatever you had and the too much time you spent talking to Jack or Susie or whatever, right? So all this is going through your head, which means you're not clear, you're not focusing on what you need to be doing, even if it's going on in the back burner and you're unconscious, right? It's still distracting your prefrontal lobes from doing what they need to do. It's filling up the RAM computer with too much shit, right? About 3 or 4 in the morning, you're starting to get really tired. And so now what you're doing is you're going to make a decision probably to do some amphetamines. And most of you who don't want to do uber bad amphetamines are going to do coffee and, you know, whatever, but some of you are going to do other amphetamines that are more stupid to do, like cocaine or whatever. So, you know, you show up to the test, right, and you know what's going to happen Monday. You're going to not going to do what you wanted to do. You know, if you're really, really lucky, you'll pass the test. You do, you know, and now you're beating the crap out of yourself. And whether you flunk or not, or whether you just barely pass and you don't make the grade you wanted to make, or you're disappointed, now you're beating the crap out of yourself, right? So now you're depressing yourself. You're choosing to beat yourself up as opposed to going, wait a minute, I made a mistake. Let me go back and see. Let me retrace my steps. You're beating the crap out of yourself, right? Particularly if you're as compulsive as I am. You know, I know a lot about self-flagellation, okay? And I'm not talking about the time I was, you know, a Clisty monk back in the day. And for those of you who don't know who the Clisty is, they're a they're an organization that was around in Russian times, around the time of Tsar Nicholas and before. And they were an interesting bunch who for whom one of their members was reputed to be Rasputin, no pun intended there. Seriously, for a change, no pun, okay? Honestly. All right, upon my word, right? Okay, yeah, that was a pretty liberal one. I know, my jokes suck. Okay, come on, guys and gals, give me a break here. But anyway, the Clisty's theology was, we're going to sin as much as possible. So we're going to drink and, you know, exhibit debauchery and mass, you know, sex orgies and all kind of beating each other up with whips and chains and woo and all kinds of cool shit. Because the more we sin, the more we have to repent, which means we're going to be closer to God. And so since God loves sinners to repent, the more we repent, the closer to God we are. So we got to sin like crazy so we can repent like crazy so we can go back and sin some more and get even closer to God. And I say it jokingly, but I'm serious. That really was the theological stance of those guys. So we're not talking about the flagellation that the Clisty and many other ancient medieval monk orders used to do. To castigate yourself of the sin of the body, right? I'm talking about beating myself up emotionally. And unfortunately, us good obsessive compulsive types, whether you're full-blown OCD, just have OC tendencies or OCPD such as I am, you are really good at beating the crap out of yourself and wallowing in the mire of self-hatred and self-loathing and to some degree self-pity, but mostly just beating the crap out of yourself and feeling like crap. Okay, so depression's lowering your brain chemistry and making you sad and making you tired, right? This is a great idea, right? No. So, you know, you're looking back at the mistakes you made, you're beating the crap out of yourself, and you're getting kind of depressed. Well, you know, then you decide, I need something to pick me up, I need something to make me feel better, I'm going to go out drinking, or I'm going to go out whatever, right? So you can see where this goes. And if you're a person who has a problem with any kind of substances, whether the, you know, with sugar, the most addictive drug on the planet, and I'm not kidding, or cigarettes, or, you know, Coke, or whatever your deal is, and let's face it, guys and gals, you know, an addiction is an addiction. So if your thing is shopping, spending, texting, sexing, hoarding, they're all addictions, right? Don't kid yourself. So whatever your compulsive, addictive dilly of choice is, that's what you're going to do when you feel bad. And you made a choice to do that, and then you're beating yourself up, and you can see where this goes, right? So this is the thing of relapses. This is the thing of self-castigation, and this is a time waster. Right. Now, having said that, I've done my share of it, so it's not as if I'm some innocent guy over here with a halo over my head, you know, casting stones upon everybody. That is definitely not the case. I'm actually trying to teach people to learn from, you know, my mistakes and the mistakes, I'm sure, of hundreds of thousands of other folks who do the same stuff I used to do and occasionally still do when I'm not on my game, right? Because we're not God. We're all imperfect. We're going to make errors, okay? But my point being, you need to start looking at the small decisions you make every day, right? Decision to make a list before you go to the grocery store. Oh, I remember. Yeah, and you go to the grocery store and you buy a few things and you see something you haven't had in a long time and you're like, oh my God, sour cream and salsa pork rinds. You know, one of Beavis and Butthead's favorites, right? And you're grabbing the sour cream. Oh my God, I'm so excited, right? And you put them in the basket and you go out to the checkout counter and you got your milk and you got your eggs and you got your bread and you got your sour cream and salsa pork rinds and you get in the car and you start the engine and you drive home and you go, oh shit, I forgot the cheese or the milk or fill in the blank, right? Can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. But I can tell you it hadn't happened to me in a long flipping time because I make lists now. I put them on my cell phone, right? And which is a miracle for an electronic idiot such as myself, but I digress yet again. Or I take a piece of paper and pencil and write them out the old-fashioned way, right? That's something I can do. And I just take them in, and when I'm done, I throw the paper away in the trash as I'm leaving the grocery store. I mean, you guys think I'm kidding, but I'm really, really not, right? Because I know I've been excited. I'll see, oh, my God, they've got plums on sale. Oh, my God, you know, they've got figs on sale, or they got, you know, fill in the blank. I'm a sale freak, right? So, you know, most of you who don't know me probably don't know I'm a cheapskate, but trust me, you know, to quote a line from a famous blues song, hold on to that dollar till the eagle grins. and some people would go, dude, you don't get as much musical gear as you have by being a cheapskate. Oh, yes, you do. Because if you don't have a boatload of income coming in and you're not Jackie Onassis or you're not Ted Turner, right, or some other rich person with an inheritance, you have to, get stuff cheaper than other folks would pay for it. So I have definitely scrimped and saved and, bargained my way into a lot of gear, but I haven't paid a whole lot of money for a lot of the gear that I have, relatively speaking. Now, let's be honest, okay, relatively speaking. So I'm like that I'm like that with everything, right? I just am. I'm a cheapie. So, yeah, what can I tell you? So I get real excited on sales. Right. So I typically don't buy stuff unless it's on a bargain, unless I have to have it. And that includes groceries. I wait till they put them on sale. I watch the flyers. I'm terrible, really. But it's those kind of decisions, making lists of stuff that you need so that you don't get distracted. So if you see something on sale like me, or you see something you haven't had in a long time, you go, oh, my God, can't believe they had that. Or, oh, my gosh, my grocery store got that. Or you walk into a music store. Right. That's the other thing I don't ever do. Right. And folks who've heard prior podcasts have heard me joke about leaving my wallet and credit cards in my car when I go into a music store because I'm such a gearhead. And that's true. I mean, that is no joke, right? I take exactly how much money. If I'm going in to buy strings or a strap or something, I take just enough money to get what I want. And I have to go back to the car. If I see something else, I have to go back to the car to get my wallet and my money, and I'm, more money, and I'm thinking about, okay, do I really want this? I'm not jazzing myself up, and oh my God, it'll look great, and I think I've told most folks on prior podcasts, but it probably bears repeating. I have a 2-week rule when I see new gear, which is I have to wait at least 2 weeks. So if it's like a guitar or an amp or a bass or, balalaiki or mandolin or whatever, I look at it, I'll touch it. I'll play it in the store. It has to look good, according to me, and I know that's subjective. It has to sound good, and I know that's subjective, and it has to play really well. If it fails any of the three tests, it's done. But let's say it passed the three tests. Then I say, okay, it's really good. I love it. I want it. I want it. I want it. I want it. Right, the magic bus. And I leave it on the wall for 2 weeks, and I come home and I think about it. Do I really want it? Now look up and do research on it. Okay, is there an alternative? Is there a cheaper? And then I go back and play it again, and if I still want it and feel like I need it, whatever, and and I'm not all hyped, then I will usually think about getting it, providing I can get it on sale, because that's number 4 criteria. I never pay full markup for anything, right? And I'd laugh because it's true. But at any rate, my point being, I make a bunch of decisions and I stick to my rules. So if you know what your weak points are, you think about it. You plan it out before you do stuff and you stick to your rules. You don't wait till you're in the moment to get all excited and make a bunch of decisions. Well, making a bunch of rules and thinking about the rules you're going to make way in advance before you get into potentially dangerous situations, that's taking small steps. Making a rule. Where do I get into trouble? How do I outline? Where do I usually relapse on drugs? How do I usually lose my temper and say things to folks I have no business saying, or even if I do, say it in a way that I have no business saying it, such that I lose friends, family, lovers, whatever, right, or jobs or whatever. And I deal with folks who do that a lot. They have a temper and they're like, rah! They open their mouth and, stuff flies out of it, and then two days, 2 hours, 10 minutes later, they're like, oh my God, and there's no going back. In some cases, you're done. Well, you make decisions not to do that by analyzing what steps you took to do wrong, not beating the crap out of yourself, but to analyze it and then figure out, okay, what plans can I make now What steps can I go through so that I won't have to do this again? And I tell people, do this as if you were a, you know, criminal detective looking for clues to the crime. You're Sherlock Holmes checking out to see who done it, right? You're not castigating them. You're not trying to arrest them. You're just trying to figure it out. You're going to let somebody else do the arresting, right? Or you are an archaeologist going into ancient rooms in, you know, in some kind of ruins in Crete or Egypt or Babylonia or wherever, right? You don't see those guys going into pyramids or, you know, Pompeii and the ruins and going, those dumbass Pompeians, why are they not here anymore, right? They're not there to criticize. They're there to learn. They're there to educate themselves. They're there to figure out what these folks did wrong, where they made mistakes, and what they did right. And that's the other half. You got to look at what you do right, too. Okay, that's important. Not just beating the crap out of yourself and look at what you did wrong. And again, no beating the crap out of yourself. Analyzing what steps you were taking, what thoughts you were thinking, what feelings you were feeling at the time that caused you to make an inappropriate decision, that caused you to do an inappropriate act, or not do something you needed to do. I cannot overemphasize this. I spend a lot of time with folks that I work doing the same process. This is not magic. This is not some special thing that people with egghead IQs can do. Any flipping body with an average IQ or even slightly below average to above average can do this thing. This does not take genius material, folks, but it does take you analyzing it, taking time and doing it. You know, it requires that same obscene four-letter word you folks hear me say all the doggone time. Yes, the word work. It requires work, right? It requires another four-letter word, time, right? As most good things do, right? Wine does not become great in 2 days. Right, cancer doesn't kill you in 2 days. Usually, it's a process. Okay, so you want to make wine. You don't want to breed cancer here. So you go and analyze your stuff just like an archaeologist would an ancient ruin. Archaeologists are not there to be critical parents. Archaeologists are not there to be moral, righteous, indignant, you know, fire and hellstone and brimstone preachers going, you are going to hell, you know, to the Egyptians who are not here anymore, or critical parent going, you know, how can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat? You know, and all this crap. You are there to analyze. You are not there to criticize, right? So, archaeologist, investigative reporter, criminal detective, not accuser, not prosecutor, not critical parent, not religious, righteous, beating the crap out of yourself with a stick, not self-flagellator in terms of monks or Clistes. You know, even though I'm sure the Clistie had a lot of fun doing that. This is not about really having fun or beating the crap out of yourself. This is about analyzing your thoughts and your feelings and the steps you took or didn't take or should have taken or should not have taken in order to get you from point A to point B, right? And I use it with people doing relapse prevention. I use it with people doing stupid stuff with their bodies or their mouths before it comes out or making decisions. You know, what kind of decisions are you going to make on a date? Oh, you know, I'm probably not going to have sex on this day and I don't need a condom, or hey, I don't need to have a condom because my boyfriend will bring one. Or yeah, right. Okay. I tell everybody, prepare as if the other person isn't going to do any of the work. And I know some of the work is, you know, if you're in a dating relationship or whatever, that some of the work's, you know, the other person's responsibility. Don't assume they're going to do it. Assume they're not going to do it. It's better to over-prepare than to under-prepare. It's better to be prepared and not need it than to not be prepared and go, oh shit, now what do I do? And you're caught in the heat of the moment, whether it's having intercourse or drinking and having a relapse. One beer won't kill me. One toot won't kill me. One, you know, candy bar won't kill me. One donut won't kill me. One Lay's potato chip won't kill me. Well, yeah, they won't. But a boatload of those will. And I know damn few people, particularly folks who have addictive compulsive tendencies, who can eat one potato chip, who can eat one candy bar, who can eat one donut, who can smoke one reefer joint, or unless it's a really good one and they're stoned and passed out at the end of it, or one beer or one glass of wine or one, and, you know, fill in the blank. You know, or one guitar. One good guitar deserves another. Okay, come on. So whatever your thing is, whether it's, you know, dresses or guitars or sex or rock and roll or whatever, you've got to plan this stuff out. Life is not about happy accidents. Life is about planning, work, anticipation, looking into the past and analyzing it only insofar as what did I do right so I can do it again, let's not forget that step, and what did I do wrong and how can we circumvent that. And then sometimes you're going to come up with plans to circumvent it and the plans aren't going to work out. Okay, think of it like a scientific experiment because that's really what it is, right? Talk to other people who've done it or done similar things. Hey, how did you get around that? How did you do that? Right? And try some stuff because one size doesn't fit all. Some things are going to work for you that don't work for other people, right? My Stratocaster example early on. I mean, that's a great example. Obviously, the Stratocaster is a great instrument for, you know, Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, David Gilmour and, you know, just a boatload of people, you know, a boatload of people. But not me. It's not one size fits all. Same thing with any guitar. I don't care what it is. Right? I'm not picking on Stratocasters, you know, because I got a buddy who can't do Les Pauls. They are one of my favorite guitars, but he can't do them. He hits the pickup selector. I don't know how the heck he does it, but you know, he doesn't know how I hit the knob on the Strat either, and he's a Strat freak. So you know, there you go. So all I'm saying is, try different stuff. If it doesn't work the first time, refigure it. Talk to people who know. Get their advice. Get them to help you. There's nothing to be ashamed of. At some level, all of us fail and all of us succeed at some level, right? If scientists were afraid of failure, we wouldn't have almost any of the inventions we have. We wouldn't have any of the information we have because most of those people who did came up with that stuff, those ideas, those inventions, those theories, they made a lot of mistakes before they came up with them. So always remember, this isn't about being right the first time. If you're one of those folks who can do it right the first or second time, woohoo for you. Consider yourself lucky. Because most people try a lot before they get it right. And if you know somebody that's in a similar situation or gone through stuff, ask them. If you don't, ask somebody that's smarter than you are about this stuff. Consult people like me or in my field or related fields. I mean, get it, you know, you are a data gatherer. Gather as much data and information as you can and then put it into action. Don't sit there with the data being afraid to act. You're not going to, you know, if you've got a ton of data and you don't act on it, the information without action is of no consequence and no use to you. You've got to be willing to act on it. You've got to be willing to risk, right? Another four-letter word most people don't like. But let's face it, people. Walking at your house, you're risking. Getting in a car and driving, you're risking, right? Just waking up in the morning, you're risking. Going to bed, you're risking. How do you know you're not going to die in your sleep? How do you know you're not going to get hit by a car going to get your car in a parking lot? How do you know you're not going to die of a stroke? I mean, you know, you don't. All of life is a risk. There is no such thing as a complete safe dilly. I mean, much to my chagrin, let me tell you guys and gals, nobody hates that shit worse than I do. But the reality is, life is a risk. And anything worth having is worth working for. You got to work. You got to put in the time. You got to put in the energy. You got to put in the information. You got to put in the effort. There's no getting around it. There's just not getting around it. Because if you don't do anything different, you're going to continue to get the same stuff you've already gotten, and you're going to be disappointed and disheartened and think you can't do it. And that's not true. I tell folks almost every time, and I'm going to tell you again, take your flipping power back. Every one of you listening to this podcast has power. Stop giving it away to everybody and everything else. Take it back and own it and do with it as you will, because you have the ability to do that and nobody else. And stop trying to change the world. Stop trying to change other people to fit your pathology. Focus on yourself, and you'll have more than enough work for one lifetime, let me tell you. Thanks very much for listening. I hope it was helpful, and I look forward to seeing you folks or talking to you folks again. Thanks again for folks who have stuck with me for a while, and I'm sorry it takes me, it just seems to take me about 3 weeks to get one of these out, and I wish it were different, but, you know, life's what happens when you make other plans, so there you go. Have a good one, and be wise, and make good choices. Thanks.